My wife is in a travel agent. She's currently flying back from a long weekend in Jamaica where she was doing work at Sandals. And she'll be happy to know that while she was gone, a woman was dreaming about me at night. Because it's all I got.
Just libraries.
Just libraries, okay. Yeah, we all know that stereotype. All right. So I want to talk to you today about mapping communities. And when Mary Carroll was kind enough to invite me, she said, you know, the people who come to this meeting, it's great that we can talk to them, but they really want to actually learn and do something for a change. So we have an activity. I want to set it up, do an activity, do some debrief, and then some final thoughts. And I start with the idea of mapping a community. Many of you have probably seen this illustration on the New Yorker. This is a New Yorker's view of the rest of the world, which is pretty accurate, I think. So a lot of what we're going to talk about is sort of the change and migration of libraries. And I'm going to use this fiction that we all use, that libraries do anything other than exert gravity and shield you from the rain, because we know that it is librarians and library staff that do things, the buildings don't. But if I slip into that, I apologize. So here's my agenda for the morning. Hopefully, there we go. So we're going to do a little setting of the stage, give you some reason for why we're going to talk about communities, how we're going to talk about communities. Then I'm going to break us up into groups, and so I may move a few of you around just because it's more fun that way, and we have a limited number of big white pieces of paper. And that's going to be the majority of our morning. We're going to debrief from that, and then finally a little concluding thoughts. My overall attempt here is to talk about a trajectory that I think that libraries and librarians are taking institutions of libraries. And that trajectory really, you know, we could go back 3,000 years, but then there are a couple of bumps along the road. So I'm going to look really within the past, say, 30 years, and a trajectory I think we're right in the middle of. And I think it's a fabulous time to be a librarian. I think it's a fabulous time to work and sustain an organization like a library. I was talking to a library director, and this library director said, I have a lot of staff that come up to me and say, oh my God, all this change, how horrible. And the library director was going, all this change, how wonderful. You know, we can do whatever we want. This is a great opportunity for us to play. And I was taking this message, and I was in Fairfield, Connecticut. And Fairfield, Connecticut had this wonderful street sign out in front of it, which is its 35th anniversary, which is great. But over there, you'll see this little sign that says, great libraries build communities. I apologize for those in the back. And unfortunately, underneath it is my name because it's part of a quote. And the rest of the quote goes like this. Bad libraries build collections, good libraries build services, great libraries build community. Now, I put this out as a tweet, so of course it's obviously nuanced with all the underlying theory and such, and it keeps getting repeated and people yell back and forth about it. And I want to break it down for you for a bit. So, bad libraries build collections. And you're sitting there going, my library builds a collection, screw you, Dave. No, maybe not. Maybe you're more polite than that. But my point here is really it's a matter of focus. That when you look at a library as an institution, as an organization, or you look at the work of librarians, and you say, where are they focused? And you can define that in budget. You can define that in mission statements. You can define that in activities during the day. You can define that in value statements. And when we look at a focus, we see that there are a lot of libraries and library organizations that have a focus around collections. We see that we have a lot of communities that look at libraries and their focus is around collections and materials and books. What is the value? Even when you hear this wonderful advertising spin of we're more than books, anyone ever heard or read the book Don't Think of an Elephant? It was a great book. It was written by a political strategist, and it's a nice little piece of psychology that when you tell someone not to think of something, they can't help but think of it, right? So when you say, don't think of the color red, boom, it's there, right? Don't think of an elephant, boom, it's there. And what's amazing is they found through memory that if you keep hitting the same sort of memory and keywords over and over and over again, they get reinforced, and they lose context. And so, for example, this political strategist was talking about how politicians end up in trouble. And the first thing they do is they get up and they refute the accusation. And in doing so, they repeat the accusation. And in doing so, they are reinforcing the accusation. So, I am not a crook. Well, if the narrative is crook, what you heard was mumble, mumble, crook, right? If you see things like, I did not sleep with that, you get it? Right? So this idea that we're more than books, what we're really doing is we may be more than books, but reinforcing the book, and we'll get back to that in a second. So I want to show you how this shows up in sort of unintended ways. This is an image that many of our communities, and I know it's small, but this is an image that many of our communities have about libraries, which is, you know, psychopathic hoarding, really, is right? What's the difference between a hoarder and a librarian? Canvas bags. That's all I'm going to say. You've been to a conference. You know I'm right. Anyway, but this idea, this image of a library's got stuff, and it's got so much. I don't know if you can see this, but it's got so much stuff. They've actually packed books on top of the shelves. They've packed around the columns to pack books. Right? This is the Philadelphia Free Library. And the Philadelphia Free Library had a really interesting situation. They were going to build an expansion. This was going to be their once a century expansion of their downtown Beaux-Arts library. And they went, and the head of the foundation, who's now the president of the Brooklyn Public Library, Linda Johnson, went to the librarians and said, what do you want, what do you want, what do you want, what do you want? Once a century, think big. And they said, compact shelving. We went from, like, you know, we had 100,000 items when we opened this building. We now have 3 million. We need a place to put them. We want compact shelving. And she said, no, I am not going to go to rich people who never show up in this building anyway and ask them for compact shelving. Think bigger. Think different. Now, what's interesting is this image that most of our public has and that, frankly, we live in to a degree is a relatively recent image. This idea of books, we sort of retroactively apply this vision back through libraries. We think this is how libraries always look. This is, in fact, the same building, the same room, in 1920. If you'd like to see, the books are right there. The rest is reading rooms. The rest is lights. They obscured all of this light, right? It's why? Well, they didn't have as many books. True. But it's very interesting that Corinne Hill, when she was looking to redesign libraries in the Dallas Public Library, said, how are you designing? She goes, I put the interaction space in the middle and books around the outside like art. And people said, oh, you're saying they're decorative? She goes, you don't understand art. For centuries and centuries and centuries, art was how we provoked. Art was how we taught. Art is how we turned messages and narratives and told stories. That's available to you to bring into the conversations we're having when we're doing the business. So it's not out there for decoration, but it doesn't get in the way of the discussion. I go into school libraries, and it's just amazing when you go into school libraries because it's like, what do you think of my library? It's like, well, where do the kids work? Well, we have this table sort of in the corner. But if it's stack upon stack upon stack, or no, we had to lower the stack so we could watch them, right? Where do they do their work? So this happened in the 1950s and 1940s. When post-war paper production, paper cost, ink cost, production cost plummeted. And so libraries were busy collecting everything because publishers were being very discreet because of cost and what they were putting out. Well, when publishers realized that for the amount of money it took them to produce one book, they could now produce 8 of them, and they only needed one of them to hit to make money, they started making 8, and then 16, and then 32. And the number of titles skyrocketed. Some could argue about the quality, right? But libraries still, in a comprehensive way, let's get it, let's get it, let's get it. And so this mashup of libraries thinking they need to be comprehensive because they sort of could trust the quality coming out of publishers, at the same time of publishers increasing production to increase market share, smash together, and we end up with this new image of a library. And it's a new image of a library. Now, what's amazing is in that don't think of an elephant modality, we take this concept and we then reflect back. So has anyone gone to Disney World or Epcot? Disney World? This is the, right? Did you do the what is it, Spaceship Earth? No? It's the one where you sit and they take you back in time, right? And Judi Dench, Dame Judi Dench comes.
And here we see the, you know, cavemen attacking the mastodon. And then, you know, she gets to the idea of we invented writing and civilization began.
And my wife hates me going on this ride because there's suddenly this scream throughout going, what a documentalist perspective. This is garbage. It's like, you know, professors should not be allowed on Disney ride. I mean, it's, you know, Space Mountain. This is astronomically incorrect. What? You know. But we see this when we think about the library, the Great Library of Alexandria. When you think about the Great Library of Alexandria 3,000 years ago, you say, oh, it was the greatest collection of knowledge. We'll get there later. Scrolls in the world, right? And oh, then if you're anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, anti-Christian, anti-pagan, anti-something, someone came in and destroyed it, right? So it was either the Arabs killed it, or the Christians killed it, or the Jews killed it, or someone killed it, right? Even though these days we're finding out probably not. But this image of the Library of Alexandria as a bunch of stuff is actually a very incorrect image, because the archaeologists, when they go and dig it up, what they find is they find out, first of all, it was a campus. It wasn't just one building. It was multiple buildings. And what happened was the librarian of Alexandria, who was one of the closest advisors to the kings and queens, went out and got scholars and experts from all over the known world and brought them together. It was one of the first think tanks in economic development. The main building was more of a dormitory than it was a collection spot. They built it in such a way that the scholars had to interact. And when they came up with brilliant ideas, when they studied, when they brought in the art from the corners, and they came up, then yes, they might write it on a scroll or chisel it in a tablet. But most of those went to another building that was a building built dedicated to the muses, called a musée, which is where we get the word museum. And so this concept of the Library of Alexandria is really part of this sort of collection focus. It was an active learning space. It was really a precursor to the modern university, not to the modern hoarding center. But let's face it, book. We know that this is, I mean, OCLC does its environmental scan. They redo the environmental scan. They ask the wonderful, fabulous question from academic to public to school to special. When you think of a library, what one word comes up? Book. But I wanted, this is really problematic, because words matter in context. When you use a word, it matters what you mean by it. So do you mean something you do for reading? Is it a reading device? Do you really mean it as a substitute for knowledge? That's where the knowledge is, right? Because if the knowledge is in the book, I would really like to figure out how to get it out, because in sixth grade, trying to pass French, it wasn't coming on its own, right? I slept on it, I hauled it around, maybe I could have read it, I realized, but I couldn't find it anywhere in, and the teacher therefore could not find any knowledge of French within me. So, is it an artifact? I love this one. I get lots of library trustees coming up and saying, well, you're in the book business. I say, yes, and we suck at it. And they say, well, what do you mean? You got plenty of them. I said, yeah, but what do when we get a book? We cover it in plastic and we plaster stickers on it, right? We just lower the resale value dramatically within seconds. And then, God help us, we lend it to people with, like, that they eat by it and they drink around it. Linda Johnson, we were walking into the free library, said, has this wonderful sign, do not bring food within this institution. She goes, this is great because we're about to open a cafe 10 feet from here, but... The other one is, what happens? They check out a book, they go home, they sit down, they get a drink, they eat. Why does it matter where we're doing this? Because the carpet cost? Okay, but let's be honest about what it is. Do they really mean it by a story? Stories are important. We're going to talk a little bit later about knowledge and what knowledge means. Story's not a bad metaphor as well. We were just having a discussion beforehand about the role of fiction in stories, and there were some people talking about development of women's rights and women's independence in Africa. And they said one of the real limiters is actually their access to fiction, their access to narratives that don't have the submissive wife, who don't have the this is what women do, but have narratives on dystopian futures and have all these stories that create a range of possibilities. Is that what people mean? Because we talk about entertainment. But is entertainment just another way of learning? It's just like fun learning, right? The fact that my son can recite, like, you know, every episode of Psych, right? Why a 14-year... Psych. right? Not Star Trek like he should. He started watching Twilight Zone. I was happy. He started watching Battlestar Galactica, the original 80s version. I was very happy, right? But, you know, Psych is what he watches. He watches USA Network's Psych. It's fine. It's Columbo-like, but I'll go with it. Anyway, so that memorization, he's learning. You know, you say, well, that's not what I want him to learn. I want him to learn astrophysics and all. He'll get there. But we learn from this. The real question is, why do we have them? And this is where we're moving into. Why do we collect books, pay for databases, have materials? That collection focus. We spend so much time in the collection, we have to go back to what was the original spark that brought us here and that can continue, right? Do we look at books as a way of distraction, right? In the 1800s, the public libraries in England created gaming parlors within the libraries. You could come and you could play pool and you could play cards. And they created them to try and get the gentlemen out of the pubs and into a more esteemed environment. Right? They wanted to take the beer away from pool, which really, why do it? But anyway, so is this a distraction? Do we bring people here to distract them? Is the school library a place to get away from bullies and then read the books and not be social anymore? Is the public library a place where, you know, the nice old ladies come to knit and that's fine? Or do we, good story on that one. I bring that up not to be stereotypical. Meg Bacchus, who was at Chattanooga, was at NOPL. She started a knitting club, and there's like a World Knitting Day, and they decided they wanted to have an event. And there was a, it's Cracker Barrel up the street, which has a porch and things. They said, we'll go knit on the Cracker Barrel. So they called up, and Cracker Barrel said, no, you can't have our rocking chairs. No, please, no. So they had a knit-in at Cracker Barrel. Right? They just went and started knitting anyway, right? And started covering things in, like, wool. It was hilarious, right? So even this is showing political action, empowerment, the idea of power, citizen action, right? Why do we have it? Do we really talk about empowerment? And if what we're really empowering our students, our faculty, our children, our parents, our teachers, what have you, we have to have power to give them. This idea that librarians can be meek and mild and neutral, which is the same root word as neutered, that we can sit back and someone will be magically given power is insane. If you help someone, teach them to read, provide the facility of reading, if you provide access to public service, if you provide access to debate and knowledge, you are empowering them, and that means that you yourself have to have the power to give away. Librarians must be powerful. Is it for democratic action, right? We love to talk about the American dream. We love to talk about economic development, but what about democratic development? When did the American dream go from the ability to rule and control ourselves as citizens and rights of citizens and have the ability to make a decent wage to being 1% by developing the next fancy app, right? Is that the conversation we want to be part of? When we talk about democratic action, oh no, we can't do politics, but you have a polling booth in your building. If we look at neighborhoods with libraries in it, do we see greater voter participation? If we don't, do we really promote democratic participation? How do we do that? Right? So this idea, economic development, certainly does fit in there as well. My question of this is, even if you're collection focused, what does that collection, what is it supposed to do, right? And so we know this, right? You're sitting there going, Dave, come on, that's so 1994, move on, right? So what we've done is we've replaced it with the idea of services. So good libraries build services, and that means that the collection is just one service. And then you say, well, a collection isn't a service, right? Services is reference and helping people. No, a collection's a service. Having things organized is a service. The National Science Foundation, when they were going to build a National Science Digital Library, discovered this because they gave out two kinds of grants. One grant was a collection grant, and one grant was a services grant. And the collection grant was given to people where they would create like this massive database of all these 3D molecules online. So you could surf through caffeine, which was lovely. Right? And the services group was working on search and visualization. And then in year 3, they said, all right, now come together. And what they found was they would knock on the doors of collections and say, can we have your collection? And they'd say, sure, here it is. By the way, it's organized according to this schema, you know, from Dewey to Library of Congress to a molecular schema to mesh to whatever, right? And then the services were sitting there going, no, 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 we organize. Wait, how do you, just organizing is a service. The fact that they allow people to wander through books, access, is a service. Remember that in many parts of this world today, and in many parts of the United States throughout its history, we didn't have open stacks. Browsing is a service. And so we say, oh, that's right, because we're community-focused, we're service-focused, right? And so you see this in things like ACRLs move from outputs to outcomes. If you want to know what a good academic library is, you no longer start going 1, 2, 3, and finish with, right, counting. Though if you're an ARL, you count. And we found this was really crazy because, right, it was like when Harvard went to weed, you'd see universities backing trucks up to take their discarded books so they could put them on their shelves, increase their volume count, increase their ARL rankings, because that's what we really intended, right? So we moved from outputs, what you can count, to outcomes, right? So did people learn? Did research increase? I see all of this wonderful stuff. Syracuse just had a sort of 30th anniversary, no, yeah, of the Byrd Library, our big sort of brutalist structure, built in 1972. Yeah, so we didn't just have it. But anyway, there was a quote going, oh man, we need at least $7 million so we can get to 50th ranks in the ARL statistics. And I thought this was a delight. This is kind of like evaluating a lion tamer based on the length of their whip versus the people that the lion didn't eat. Right? What's the focus here? What do we want the outcome to be? Do we want greater student retention? Do we want greater student learning? What part of that A in Psych 101 came from the library being there? We see this focus in schools. ASL has moved us, first of all, from school librarians to being library media specialists to now we're school librarians again. But we talk about a curriculum. We're no longer clerks, we're no longer managing a room, we're no longer checking things out. We're teachers, we're certified teachers, and we own a curriculum that is much more important in the days of core, of the Common Core than it ever was before. But that idea that we do something more than the materials, we're a focus, we're service, we teach, we educate. We see this, Geneseo College has really been a real big proponent of this. Every librarian is an educator, every librarian. If you catalog the books, if you're a school librarian, if you're sitting in the public library and you're doing a program, every one of you is an educator. You're all about learning, right? And in public libraries, if you haven't been paying attention to ALA, now might be the time to tune in because for the past 4 presidencies, it's all been a focus using Harwood Institute and such on community outreach, community engagement, community promotion. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk communities. Right? And what we want to do is, in this sort of service focus, who are we serving? Because if the answer is everyone, that means you're doing no one well. So what we're going to do is we're going to put you together in teams, and we're going to run you through an exercise this morning called Map a Conversation Map. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But we're beginning to then shift how we're thinking about from this collection centrality to a service centrality. And it's not surprising that it was a relatively easy shift for us to make. I mean, you probably struggled a little bit with, yeah, but I want to draw the collection because it's important, it goes to all of them. And that's great, but it's still a service. Your group had organizing. The fact that it's not just a collection, it's an organized collection that can come in. My question back was, if that's a service you provide to yourself, is that a service you might also be able to provide to others? So the story there is a member, patron, walked into the Ann Arbor District Library up in Michigan and said, you know how I can, he went to the associate director, Eli Nyberg, who put together their online catalog. He goes, you know I can go to that catalog and I can find a book in your library? And Eli said, yes. You know how I can find out if it's not here, it's at that branch down the street? And Eli said, yes. He said, is there a reason that I can't put my books in there and if someone wants to borrow it, I can just bring it in the next day? Now, if you're collection focused, that's really weird. Yeah, it's like, no, we don't want your stinking books and it might get ripped up and someone might spill coffee and do we have to put a spine number on it? And what, right? But if you're thinking instead of this sort of community service focus, that idea of connecting people in their conversations, connecting people with their materials, connecting, becomes a very interesting and powerful dynamic. Once again, I had a large urban library. They had renters that said, we want to have a meeting with other renters. We want to get together and talk about renters' rights and landlords and issues. And the landlords came to the library and said, we want a landlord's meeting now. And they said, and we want to make it very clear, we don't want anyone in there but us landlords. Because we're going to talk about things like what happens when you rent to illegal immigrants, what happens when you rent an illegal sublet, right? And so, once again, question, does the library want to serve that? Does it not? Or do you want to serve it by saying, hey, it's public space. We want to not be at that meeting, right? So, something to think about. All right. So we move from this idea of the collection focus to a service focus. And once again, I don't think that was a hard switch for us. But in my remaining few minutes, I'm going to argue that there is a next focus to go to, a next progression. And I'm going to do it by showing you a scrap of paper, which I know is a virtual scrap of paper, but stick with me for a minute. What are you passionate about? I'm going to tell you where that piece of paper came from, but I'm going to do it by telling you a story. And the story begins with this. Anyone know what that is? A brush or bristle brush. What you do is you take a toothbrush, you cut off the bristles, and you attach to it a battery and a very old, because they're very cheap, because no one has them anymore, pager motor. So when your phone goes bzzz, or when your pager used to go bzzz, that's it. And what happens is, when you connect the two, your BristleBot goes bzzz, and it begins to move. And you can then race them, you can then put them on tables and try and make them go tracks, and this is a cool activity. So I'm gonna talk about the Fayetteville Free Library, which is about, right up by Syracuse, but happens a lot of domains. I brought my, at the time, 6-year-old to this activity. I knew the librarians, and so I was hanging out with the librarians. And what happens is, the 6-year-olds were pretty good. They got to the point, they connected the battery, and the BristleBot went bzzz. And they replaced the battery, and they put it on and went bzzz. Turns out the librarians had bought not a hearing aid battery that lasts a long time, but like a little pen light battery that this thing just ate right through. So all the librarians suddenly had this look of horror and huddled in a corner. Where they were sitting there going, all right, can we get to the hardware store? I don't know. Do we have a purchase order? Do I have to use my own money to do that? What are you talking about? Meanwhile, while the librarians are sitting in the corner, the kids are sitting there going, hey, I got a AA battery. Let's see what happens with that. And hey, it won't fit on this. Why not just have a whole battery? Do we have anyone have duct tape? Within 10 minutes, they had bristle, like, armored cars and bristle batteries and bristle destruction cooler. And they just went crazy. And this light went off at the same time with all librarians and me. We just looked at it and said, wait a minute, we were doing this wrong. This is about them, not our ability to teach them. And they're creating this event in a much more authentic and interesting way. They had a 3D printer, and they would bring out the 3D printer. And what they were really getting kind of annoyed, because what happened is they were thinking, oh, people are going to create and make the whole new generation of life and maker and yay. And instead they were getting 10-year-olds going, I downloaded, the 3D version of a bunny. Print it for me, please. Oh, I got cookie cutters. I found them online. Print them for me, please. In essence, they were looking at this 3D printer the same way they looked at a Xerox machine. The librarian said, no, we're going to create a maker culture in which we all participate. And people are going, no, consumer culture, give it to me. Right? And so Fayetteville now has this maker space. But what's really interesting is that 3D printers are behind these ladies. But they have craft tables, they have sewing machines, which are frankly much scarier than the 3D printers. They have a whole rack of tools, they have a laser etcher, they have sewing, they have all this stuff going on. And they have programs around it, but they learned that what they can't do is say, we know it all. So the librarians didn't bring in the sewing machines and said, now we're going to become expert sewers. Now we're going to become expert carpenters. Now, what they did is they began saying, you know how to sew. Would you handle this one for me? You know how to knit. Take that one. Oh, I just spent all weekend redoing my shower with a friend who knew what the hell he was doing. But so if you look at my hands, I do not actually have a disease, but I am water sailed. So they started having home improvement, how to do electrical work, and the librarians weren't teaching it. They were identifying the people to come in and do it. And what's very interesting is they took this maker idea and they didn't just confine it to one room. So this is the little maker space that's in the young adult area. The teens has their own space, which has video production and a green wall. I mean, just a tiny little tutoring room that they turned into media production. They have another one. Their computer lab every month becomes a Minecraft tournament. But here's what's interesting. Librarian, loving it, knew about Minecraft, new kids loved Minecraft, set up the first tournament, capture the flag. Teens came to the librarians afterward and said, oh, that sucked. And they said, what's wrong? And they said, your world, you didn't use this mod, you didn't do this. And the teens without, the librarians without missing a beat said, great, you're building the next one. And you're building the next one, and you're putting it together. And so this maker culture goes all through. They got this area with the cutouts and puppets. The young adults just make those crafts from story time or on their own and come over, and they, in essence, curate that environment. That's their space. That's what they own. And so they then have the idea that they looked at geek girls, summer camps. So this is the geek girl summer camp. This is the classic not enough women in STEM fields. So what did they do? They had a summer camp. Did they sit there and teach it? No, they brought in a reservist from the Air National Guard who was a woman and a mother who came in full flight suit, came with the two helmets so they could do walkie-talkies back and forth, and walked them through it with a simulator, an hour, 2 hours worth of talking about women in the military and issues of motherhood and all of these things combined. They brought in the biggest problem was figuring out how to bring a concrete mixer full of, is it baking soda and water? It makes a non-Newtonian, what is it? No. This is, I forget what it is, but it makes a non-Newtonian fluid, which is, if you smack it, it's a solid, but if you put your cornstarch. So they put out 9 yards of cornstarch so that the girls could run across it and jump on it. They built catapults. So in the library, there were like these pom-poms flying across the shelves and the decks. And so they tried it. And they said, well, we do it differently. And what about boys? And we can do this. And now they're getting into the summer camp business. Where does it come from? Whenever you check out a tablet, whenever you check out a 3D printer, whenever you come into their activities, they hand you this form. This form starts with, what do you love to do? What are you passionate about? And they said, it's really weird when you go up to a member and say, what are you passionate about? They sort of walk backwards a little bit. But then the next one, would you be interested in sharing what you know / teaching it to your neighbors, to the community? And that's how they begin building their communities. They said, we took our volunteers and we changed 180 degrees how we thought about them. Rather than thinking about them as how could these volunteers help me do my job, we turned it around so the librarian's question is, how can I help the volunteer do their job? How can I release their expertise? So for example, from this program, from this simple survey, they've done things like sewing and knitting. They've had lectures on Civil War, Lego and robotics competitions, Minecraft competitions, gaming tournaments. In essence, they're building their programming from this. Now, I get a lot of people saying, well, what's the librarian's job then? The librarian doesn't do anything? No. You don't just get to say, I'm a Civil War expert. I'm going to stand up and do it. The librarian's job is the same job it's always been, which is to facilitate knowledge creation. These are their collection. This is their tools. And just like you do collection development around articles and materials, they do collection development around their community. Oh, you want to teach something in the Civil War? Let's meet next Thursday and you can go over the topic and I can find out if you're nuts. I can find out, can you do public speaking? And maybe I say, you know, maybe not a public event. Maybe you could help us put together a LibGuide. Maybe you could help us put together these resources. And so what they're doing is they're finding out what are people's expertise and their abilities, helping them match those abilities and then bringing them to the community. When I brought my 6-year-old for the Bristlebrot, my 9-year-old was next to him. And they said, next week we're having a session, we're bringing the 3D printer, and we want to do duct tape stuff, but I don't have anyone to teach it. Now, if you didn't know and you thought duct tape was simply a way to adhere two items together, you have not met duct tape. Duct tape makes apparently an excellent wedding dress. Didn't know that. it makes my from my son makes weapons. We're watching him. We know it's going to be. He was so quiet. We're working on that. But in a second, he had his phone out and saying, "Look, I did this and I did this and this." And the librarian, without a thought, said, "Great, you're teaching it." That ride home, all I heard about the best trip to the library ever. Amazing. And you're sitting there going, "Oh, great, Dave. I'm in an academic library. I can't do that." Why can't an academic library be a clinical teaching environment? Now, at Syracuse, we have library science students, and they can go and do it. Yay, that makes sense. But why not when that faculty member walks in and says, "I have a new research grant, I need to build a blog," we don't pull someone from computer science and video production and architecture who can do design plans, and we bring in people from illustration to help illustrate what they're doing, and we have these people, in essence, ready, armed, and on staff. We have teams in our academic disciplines that we can bring through work study, through GAs, or simple volunteering efforts to go and do these activities. Just like we team librarians to answer these service issues, why don't we team the entire university around it? So then when they say, "What exactly did you contribute to the research environment?" and they're looking for the overhead you brought in from your research grant, you can say, "We didn't really bring in that much overhead. Oh, but by the way, we were an integral part of $2.5 million of research grants, and these were the roles we played, and this is how we did it." What about, this is my favorite for special librarians, if a U.S. Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, they have the criminal section and they have the civil, which is environmental discrimination, these kinds of things. And I was talking to a lawyer and he said, "I'm in environmental law." He says, "What we have to do is we have to deal with witnesses. We have to identify them, interrogate them, figure out, get information, et cetera, refute them." He goes, "If I'm on the criminal side, I can send the U.S. Marshals or the FBI to go more or less rough them up." Right? If they don't want to talk to me, I can send someone with a gun and a badge. I'm in environmental law. I don't have that. He goes, "Well, what I do have is librarians." He says, "I have librarians, and what they've in essence done is created sort of embedded librarians that work in the prosecutorial team. And they go do online investigation, find information, and they've been given special rights. So, for example, they can do public record searches with Social Security numbers. They can go in and find that information. And so they're embedded right within the direct processes. School librarians, I'll talk about why there's a camper in a second. Sue Kowalski at East Syracuse Manoa won the ASL program award a couple years ago. She has what they call the I-team. Students come in, they do the shelving. And they like it because they can put it in the right order. They do the ordering. When it becomes ordering time, she puts out a bunch of materials and books and say, "All right, what are we going to get?" And they actually go in and do the ordering back and forth. They do tech support. So when a teacher says, "I want a new project on," Sue and the teacher work out the curriculum, and she can then assign students to go in and support them with, "Oh, I know how to do Canvas. I know how to do this online tool." And they begin supporting them and assigning them as more or less graduate assistants for eighth graders. That you get your own graduate assistant to help you do the research and materials and pull it together. The camper is, this year they're redoing her building, and they've taken the middle school and they put them in multiple buildings, like eighth graders go to the high school. So she got the principal to buy her a used camper that she then goes, and not only does she take materials and technology, but programs, and she drives from school to school to support them. So why is this a library? Why isn't this a community center? Why are we doing this and talking about the changes? Because aren't we just about books and collections? When we felt centered around books and collections, it made sense for us to have space. But now we begin to think about, what is it that we do? What is it that makes this a library function? The libraries used to be spaces for us to do our job. It made sense to have 50% of the floor plan devoted to staff when we had huge cataloging staff and standing files and ready reference and all the stuff to go. And now the library is the place for the community to do the job, and the librarians have to get the hell out of it. Right? From Betsy going to food pantries, because that's where kids need early literacy intervention. And when you started providing early literacy, you found out the parents probably needed a little later literacy intervention. And so we began bringing in other services, and we did it at point of need. So why is that a library? We need to begin realizing the library word's not the important one. The librarian word is the important one. It's a library function or a library activity because the librarians are doing the mission that they have had since the Library of Alexandria 3,000 years ago, which is to improve society, feel free to stop there, by facilitating knowledge creation within our communities. So it's about people, not institutions. I can imagine the day, very soon, we're getting really spectacular that we now have libraries without books. Really what we have is libraries with books on screens, right? We have, when they talk about, they have all e-books and facilities. I can foresee very soon the day with librarians without a library, where the community library consists of librarians walking around with connected technology to go into centers of excellence, to go into centers of research, centers of need, centers of migration, and provide services. So it's about us as people and individuals and constantly needing to relearn. Once again, that community as the collection required librarians to do collection development to identify the maps. You mentioned the idea of the Amish connection. That happened because a person recognized it and made it happen, right? So we're talking about that. We're talking about knowledge creation, and knowledge is created by these conversations. You can't take a book and download it in your head. You have to take a person to read it. You have to talk about it. I don't know about you in math, but if I didn't have a math teacher, it wasn't happening. You need someone there to facilitate that conversation, and it doesn't have to be a librarian. As many of you have identified groups that have important discussions, that you can pull them together and then walk away, right? But you help them and bring them together. It's a civic space. When Ferguson blew up, the public library stayed open. And when they closed the schools, they had school in the public libraries. Not only that, the science museum started coming in and providing materials. Food pantries began coming in because it turns out schools provide free and reduced lunches, which is the majority of the Ferguson school population. They were at home at 2 a.m. with gunshots and with tear gas going off, with their parents sitting next to bats protecting their homes. And they were hungry because their schools were closed. And the library, you don't think the library director could have called the mayor and said, I don't think I want to open in this environment? The mayor would have said, oh no, we need the library. No, he's too busy putting body armor and Kevlar on his police. He's putting them in camouflage in downtown Ferguson, right? But what did they do? They opened up and they provided pizza, and then they provided all this thing, and it didn't happen because it was a library. It happened because the librarians could pick up the phone and could make the network they had already been built and were maintained on a regular basis happen. They talked to the science museum before that day. They talked to the food pantries before that day. They talked to this community and knew these conversations and knew how they could connect. And we provide facilitation. We provide access to those conversations, not just to materials, but people. We provide training so we know how to have conversations. We provide an environment that they feel safe in, physically safe and intellectually safe to do it. My favorite thing is the prejudice library. In Europe, you can go check out a prejudice. So if you've never talked to someone who's a Muslim, check out a Muslim, check out a Jew, check out a black, check out a French person, I don't know. You bring them together because it's a safe civic environment for them to have a conversation that they wouldn't feel comfortable in any other environment doing. Safety. Ultimately, what it comes down to is, what are you passionate about? As librarians, this is a time of great change, but it really is a huge time of great opportunity. Sit down and try for a moment to define what a library is, and I defy you to find out where that's etched in law. I was in a public library. I said, does the law tell you how long you have to be open? No. Does it tell you you have to collect books? No. Does it tell you that you have to have story time? No. So this was a decision of people. And unfortunately, it was often a decision of people 100 years ago, and we kept going with it. Why don't we stop and ask, should we keep doing this? Yes, it makes sense to have these tools and these materials. Let's try something different. Let's try something new. Rather than worrying about $6 million to get your ARL ranking up to 50th, why don't we, instead of chasing Harvard, make the academic library of the future? In 5 years, we should reinvent what an academic library looks like, because it shouldn't look like technical services and public services if the people we're serving have no idea what those are. In a time when there are no more concrete definitions of library, the passions, dreams, and aspirations of our communities will shape the library, and your passions will lead the library in doing it. This is what it comes down to. That building was named after you. I know it wasn't, but from now on, it is. We're recreating history. It's truthiness. We can do it. What we do, how we interact, the connections that we make, the community that we develop is what we will be known for. When we look to 100 years from now, we say we're going to collect for 100 years. Good luck. but we can build a community that can last for 100 years. You want to talk about an awesome collection? Look at the dreams, the aspirations, the expertise, the history, the background, the struggles, the turmoil that you have. Those prison libraries, they're not just about entertaining the prisoners. They need to be about making citizens that can participate. And the stories they can tell and the good that they can bring, if we can release it, that's what we need to spend our time on. The research that we can make happen, the cancers that we can cure, maybe not us. From now on, every professional service, library, teacher, lawyer, doctor, engineer, will be judged solely on the benefit and the good that the people they serve do, not their own actions. Your quality will be determined by your community, not by your competence. That becomes an amazing impetus and power for us. What makes a library these days is not the walls, it's not the collections, it's not the subscription. It's you in this room and the people you bring to this problem and the people you bring to this challenge. And that's what we can do, and that's what we can be a part of. Thank you very much for your time.
I'll have the slides here, hopefully in audio. The mapping exercise we did is discussed in the Atlas of New Librarianship, which is not free. The sort of general ideas of community connections is in the Six Back More book, which you can buy in paper or download for free from my website. And if you want a really harrowing tale of an amazing journey through cancer, feel free to buy that book. So I'll give away the ending. You lived.
Yay. David, thank you so much. And I hope you'll be able to join us for lunch.